and welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Associated Press, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And podcast editions of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available on our website, ncreadingservice.org. All articles featured today are read as printed. There are some weeks when I'm preparing this program that I'm struggling to find anything to fill 30 minutes. This is not one of those weeks. There are some major articles and stories going on in the world of religion and religious news this week. And so we'll start with an article from June 19th from the New York Times. The headline of this article is "Pope's Silence Speaks Volumes on Controversial Communion Vote by U.S. Bishops." The subheadline, "The Divergence of the Conservative American Church from Francis's Agenda is Now So Obvious as to Be Unremarkable, Even When U.S. Bishops Ignore a Vatican Warning." And this article is by Jason Horowitz of the New York Times, Dateline Vatican City. Pope Francis on Saturday put a founder of the European Union on the track to sainthood, told Roman deacons to take care of the poor, and met with a top prelate who once defended him against wild allegations by the Vatican's former ambassador to the United States. But the most telling thing he did was stay quiet about the extraordinary vote by America's Roman Catholic bishops to move ahead, despite the warning of the Pope's top doctrinal official, with the drafting of new guidance that conservatives hope will eventually deny communion to President Biden for his support of abortion rights. The Pope said nothing, church officials and experts said, because there is nothing else to say. "The divergence of the conservative American church from Francis's agenda is now so apparent as to become unremarkable," and Vatican officials and experts said Saturday that the Pope's silence also underlined just how unsurprising the American vote made public on Friday was to the Vatican. The deeply conservative American Bishops' Conference has already flouted a remarkably explicit letter from the Vatican in May, urging it to avoid the vote. "It has disregarded years of the Pope's pleas to de-emphasize culture war issues and expand the scope of its mission to climate change, migration, and poverty." On Friday, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops voted in a large majority and an often bitter virtual meeting to begin drafting guidance on the sacrament of the Eucharist. That guidance could become a vehicle for conservative leaders in the U.S. Church to push for denying communion to prominent Catholics like Mr. Biden, who support abortion rights. But the public silence at the Vatican on Saturday, the officials said, also reflected that the Pope and his top officials remained confident that the American conservatives would never actually pass such a doctrinal declaration on banning communion. "Church law says for that to happen, the bishops' conference would need either unanimous support, which is essentially impossible, or two-thirds support and the Vatican's approval." "It's not going to get to that point," said one senior Vatican official with knowledge of the thinking inside the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the Church's doctrinal watchdog. "It's inconceivable." President Biden, when asked about the vote yesterday, had a similar view. "That's a private matter," he told reporters, "and I don't think that's going to happen." The greatest threat posed by Friday's vote was to the unity of the American Church itself, and not to Mr. Biden and other Catholic politicians who supported abortion rights. "The vote to go ahead and draft new guidance on the issue guarantees that it will stay in the political bloodstream and grow only more potent as the American Bishops' Doctrine Committee works on the guidance ahead of a planned November meeting." And officials and clergy close to Francis worried that the communion document could be used as a wedge issue to get Republican voters to the ballot box as much as to put Catholics in the pews. Several experts said that ultimately they expected a document that strongly asserted the importance of the Eucharist, one of the most sacred rituals in Christianity, but that would reflect the Pope's concerns and not explicitly call for denying communion to Mr. Biden and other influential political and cultural figures who support abortion rights. The feeling in the Vatican is that the status quo will prevail, and that discretion on communion will be left to individual bishops. Cardinal Wilton Gregory of Washington has made it clear that he will not deny the president communion. "I don't think they are worried in Casa Marta," Paolo Rodari, a Vatican reporter at Rome's La Repubblica newspaper, said, referring to the Pope's residence. But there remains among Francis's allies in the Vatican a concern that the conservatives who dominate the conference will use the rite of communion as a political weapon, setting a bad global precedent for the politicization of a church that Francis wants to keep above the fray. The real motivation of the May letter by the Pope's top doctrinal official, Cardinal Luis Ladaria, the Vatican official said, was to avoid that, and the weakening, dividing, and politicizing of the American Church by preserving unity among its bishops. That clearly failed. Francis has repeatedly argued that collegial dialogue between bishops is key to lasting reform in the Church. Austin Ivory, a biographer of Francis, pointed out that even when bishops called to Rome voted overwhelmingly to ordain some married men as priests in remote locations, a position championed by liberals and opposed by conservatives, Francis did not ratify it because, the biographer said, of the polarization the debate revealed. Some of the Pope's disappointed backers thought he simply folded under conservative pressure. While he doesn't expect unanimity among his bishops, the Pope does want a convergence of opinion, Mr. Ivory said. For Francis, a majority vote by a deeply divided bishops' conference is not a sign that one should proceed, but the opposite, he said. He added that on substance, the vote by American bishops on Friday, with 73% in favor of drafting guidance and 24% opposed, was clearly not aligned with the Pope's priorities. Francis has been consistent in his message to the American bishops. Don't get trapped in culture wars and give a witness of unity, Mr. Ivory said. I don't think this vote does that. On a Saturday in the Hall of Blessings in the Apostolic Palace, Francis reasserted his priorities. When a group of Roman deacons asked him what he wanted from them, he responded, humility, and urged them to put themselves at the service of the poor. As the deacons left the meeting and walked out onto St. Peter's Square, several said they had never heard of an Italian priest denying communion to a politician for any reason, and that there was a clear divide between politics, which belonged in Parliament, and faith, which belonged in church. We've never sent a person away from communion, said Raffaele Grasso, a deacon at a parish in Rome. It never, ever happens here. Throughout much of Europe and Latin America, it is essentially unthinkable for bishops to deny communion to politicians who publicly support abortion rights. John Paul II famously offered communion to Francesco Rutelli, a former mayor of Rome and candidate for prime minister who supported abortion rights. Almost all of the bishops of the world at this moment look at the United States Church, said Mr. Ivory, and wonder what is going on. The American effort is a very dangerous initiative, said Alberto Meloni, a church historian in Rome, who said the Vatican had long abandoned the notion that the Catholic Church's job is to guide politics. Francis, on the papal plane in September 2019, acknowledged the sharp opposition he has faced from conservative Catholic detractors in the United States. Presented with a book that explored the ties of conservative American bishops to a well-financed and media-backed American effort to undermine his pontificate, Francis responded that it was an honor that the Americans attack me. Asked in another flight to expand on the sustained opposition he faced from Catholic conservatives in the United States, Francis said, I pray there are no schisms, adding, but I'm not scared. Friday's vote showed that not much had changed. Those ideologically driven American bishops are still against him, said Nicolas Senez, the French Vatican reporter who had presented Francis with his book, How America Wanted to Change the Pope. They are still against the reform of the church that Francis wants, and they still continue to be on the same political agenda of the Republican Party, he added. The American church is as divided as the people of the United States. From even before President Biden's inauguration, conservative bishops seemed intent on a showdown with him. In November 2020, Archbishop Jose H. Gomez of Los Angeles, president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, whom Francis has repeatedly declined to elevate to the rank of cardinal, wrote a letter warning Mr. Biden that his position on abortion rights created a difficult and complex situation. Support for abortion rights among prominent politicians who profess the Catholic faith, the Archbishop wrote, creates confusion among the faithful about what the Catholic Church actually teaches on these questions. The Archbishop then formed a working group on the issue. On Inauguration Day, Archbishop Gomez greeted the new president with a long statement warning that our new president has pledged to pursue certain policies that would advance moral evils. The Vatican, on the other hand, sent a congratulatory telegram urging the president to pursue policies marked by authentic justice and freedom. In the end, Mr. Senez said, Francis understood that only time would change the composition of the American Bishops' Conference and put the American Church in alignment with Rome. There has to be a biological solution, he said. Francis has to wait for them to retire. We'll move on to an article from the Washington Post. This article was dated June 17th. It was written by Robert Barnes. And the headline on this article, Supreme Court unanimously rules for Catholic group in Philadelphia foster care dispute. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously Thursday that Philadelphia was wrong to end a Catholic group's contract to provide foster care services because the organization refused to work with same-sex couples. It was the latest victory for religious organizations at the increasingly conservative court, and the second time it has ruled against governments trying to enforce an anti-discrimination law protecting LGBTQ rights against those claiming religious liberty. But the opinion, written by Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr., was narrow enough to draw the support of the court's three liberals and the consternation of its three most conservative members for not going further. Roberts reasoned that because Philadelphia theoretically allows some exceptions to its policy, the city had violated the Constitution's guarantee of free exercise of religion by not extending one to Catholic social services, which screens potential foster care parents. CSS seeks only an accommodation that will allow it to continue serving the children of Philadelphia in a manner consistent with its religious beliefs. It does not seek to impose those beliefs on anyone else, Roberts wrote. The refusal of Philadelphia to contract with CSS for the provision of foster care services unless it agrees to certify same-sex couples as foster parents cannot survive strict scrutiny and violates the First Amendment. The opinion was joined by conservative justices Brett M. Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, as well as the court's liberals Stephen G. Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan. The court's most conservative members, Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel A. Alito, Jr., and Neil M. Gorsuch, agreed with the outcome but were put off by its limited scope. The court has emitted a wisp of a decision that leaves religious liberty in a confused and vulnerable state, Alito wrote. Those who count on this court to stand up for the First Amendment have every right to be disappointed, as am I. Alito said Roberts' opinion hung on a glitch in Philadelphia's contractual procedures and might as well be written on the dissolving paper sold in magic shops. He said that it would be easy for Philadelphia to change its policy and that the ruling provides no guidance regarding similar controversies in other jurisdictions, such as San Francisco and D.C., whose anti-discrimination laws have caused clashes with Catholic charitable organizations. That said, the case was another clear win for religious organizations, which have found a sympathetic ear at the high court. In recent years, justices have ruled for religious organizations on resisting the provision of birth control coverage that is required of other employers, in hiring and firing decisions, in allowing public funds for religious schools, and in striking down coronavirus restrictions aimed at gatherings for worship services. Micah J. Schwartzman, a University of Virginia law professor who specializes in the intersection of law and religion, said the court's signal for social service providers is clear enough. It will grant them religious exemptions, even when doing so entails allowing them to violate anti-discrimination laws. He added, "No court in American history has been more solicitous of religious accommodations than this one." Lori Windham, a lawyer for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, who argued the case on behalf of Catholic Social Services, said the decision is a strong endorsement of religious freedom that recognizes that religious social service agencies can serve their communities and that governments should not restrict or exclude them because of their religious beliefs. Archbishop Nelson Perez of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia said in a call with reporters that the ruling is a crystal-clear affirmation of First Amendment rights for the Archdiocese of Philadelphia and all charitable ministries throughout the U.S. Philadelphia City Solicitor Diana Cortez, responding in a written statement, called the ruling a difficult and disappointing setback for foster care youth and the foster parents who work so hard to support them. The court has usurped the city's judgment that a non-discrimination policy is in the best interests of the children in its care. But, she said, the city would continue to partner with CSS. Gay rights activists also said they were relieved that the decision was not more sweeping in scope and allows local governments to continue prohibiting discrimination against LGBTQ foster and adoptive parents. Today's decision preserves the critical ability of governments to prohibit such rampant discrimination, which is an urgent need, Kathy Sakamura, deputy director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, said in a statement. Philadelphia city officials ended the contract with Catholic Social Services after a 2018 article in the Philadelphia Inquirer described its policy against placing children with same-sex couples. City officials said the agency's actions violated the city's anti-discrimination laws. The Catholic Agency and several foster parents sued. A district judge and a unanimous panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit ruled that the city was within its rights to end the contract and was not targeting the Catholic Agency for its religious views. Instead, the court said the city was simply refusing to do business with a group that would not abide by its non-discrimination policy. CSS, which has provided foster care services for decades, said the city's decision forced it to either to violate religious views about marriage or forego providing the kind of services essential to its mission. It noted that it had never been approached by a same-sex couple and that other city contractors were happy to work with those couples. Roberts made the same points in his opinion. CSS does not object to certifying gay or lesbian individuals as single foster parents or to placing gay and lesbian children, he wrote. No same-sex couple has ever sought certification from CSS. If one did, CSS would direct the couple to one of the more than 20 other agencies in the city, all of which currently certify same-sex couples. The suit had asked the court to overturn a 1990 case that, although written by the late conservative Justice Antonin Scalia, has become a target of religious conservatives. Employment Division v. Smith held that laws incidentally burdening religion are ordinarily not subject to strict scrutiny under the Free Exercise Clause so long as they are neutral and generally applicable. A government policy can survive strict scrutiny only if it advances interests of the highest order and is narrowly tailored to achieve those interests. The appeals court said that applied in this case. But Roberts found a way to avoid direct confrontation with that precedent. He said that Philadelphia's policy allowed exceptions to its non-discrimination at the sole discretion of the director. He acknowledged that the director had never given one, but said the sole discretion provision nonetheless rendered the policy no longer generally applicable. The question then is not whether the city has a compelling interest in enforcing its non-discrimination policies generally, but whether it has such an interest in denying an exception to CSS, Roberts wrote, and he found it did not. If anything, including CSS in the program seems likely to increase, not reduce, the number of available foster parents, Roberts wrote. And the city's argument that it might be sued for discrimination was only speculative. The court last looked at the clash of gay rights and religious beliefs in 2018 when it ruled for a Colorado baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Roberts quoted from language in that decision that our society has come to the recognition that gay persons and gay couples cannot be treated as social outcasts or as inferior in dignity and worth. But that weighty consideration, he wrote, cannot justify denying CSS an exception for its religious exercise. Gorsuch's concurring opinion criticized the majority for timidity in not directly confronting whether to overrule Smith. What possible benefit does the majority see in its studious indecision about Smith when the costs are so many, he asked. The particular appeal before us arises at the intersection of public accommodation laws and the First Amendment. It involves same-sex couples and the Catholic Church. Perhaps our colleagues believe today's circuitous path will at least steer the court around the controversial subject matter and avoid picking a side. The case is Fulton versus City of Philadelphia. We'll return to the New York Times now in an article from another major event that took place this week. This is from June 15th edition of the New York Times and written by Ruth Graham. The headline, Southern Baptists Narrowly Head Off Ultra-Conservative Takeover. The subheadline, Ed Litton, a moderate pastor from Alabama, won a high-stakes presidential election with the potential to reshape the future of the country's largest Protestant denomination. And this is datelined Nashville. In a dramatic showdown on Tuesday, Southern Baptists elected a moderate pastor from Alabama as their next president, narrowly heading off an attempted takeover by the denomination's insurgent right wing. The election of the pastor, Ed Litton, was the result of what was effectively a three-way standoff for the leadership of the nation's largest Protestant denomination. In the first round of voting on Tuesday afternoon, Southern Baptists rejected a prominent mainstream candidate and one-time favorite for the presidency, Al Mohler Jr., who received 26% of some 14,000 votes. The race then headed for an immediate runoff vote that pitted an ultra-conservative pastor from Georgia, Mike Stone, against Mr. Litton, who has largely avoided the culture wars. When officials announced the results from the stage, Mr. Litton bested Mr. Stone by just 556 votes, or 4 percentage points, the floor erupted in a mixture of cheers and boos. At a news conference after his victory, the soft-spoken Mr. Litton emphasized the need for healing. We're a family, Mr. Litton said. At times it seems we're incredibly dysfunctional, but we love each other. Going forward, he said, my goal is to build bridges and not walls. Some had warned that the stakes for the denomination, which often serves as a bellwether for white American evangelicalism, have never been higher. A newly empowered ultra-conservative faction in the already conservative denomination is pushing back against a national leadership they describe as out-of-touch elitists who have drifted too far to the left on social issues. Mainstream Baptist churches and those on the far right agree that the convention's results will serve as a referendum about the denomination's priorities and could accelerate the fracturing of an already shrinking institution. Delegates called messengers were voting in Nashville on a new president as well as a series of hot-button cultural issues. Some on both sides have threatened to leave depending on the final results. Pastors and activists had spent months drumming up attendance for the convention from churches large and small across the country. Conservatives especially had made an unusual effort to boost turnout. The Conservative Baptist Network, an increasingly influential group founded last year, released a video last week featuring images of an empty motorboat slipping loose from a pier and floating into the middle of a lake under cloudy skies. On June 15th, Southern Baptists can stop the drift, the network spokesman Brad Jerkovich intoned. In Nashville, tempers were running high. Irate messengers confronted at least two high-profile leaders in the halls of the convention center, accusing them of fomenting liberalism. Some leaders were provided with extra security. We were at a defining moment for our convention, J.D. Greer, the departing president, told the assembly in a fiery speech hours before they would elect his successor. He excoriated the Pharisees within the denomination who placed ideological purity over its evangelistic mission, alienating black and Latino pastors, sexual abuse survivors, and others in their zeal. Are we primarily a cultural and political affinity group, or do we see our primary calling as being a gospel witness? Mr. Greer asked. What's the more important part of our name, Southern or Baptist? Mr. Greer praised an earlier generation of conservatives who had kept the denomination true to its theological principles. But he warned of a new threat to Southern Baptists in the 21st century. The danger of liberalism is real, but the danger of Phariseeism is also, he said. Tuesday's vote capped months of angry debate over race, gender, and other cultural divides as the denomination's leaders and insurgents wrestled over whether their future hinged on wrenching the church even further to the right or broadening its reach. Last summer's annual meeting was canceled because of the coronavirus pandemic, and attendance and tension has not been this high since the mid-1990s, when conservatives completed a sweeping takeover that some now say did not go far enough. The day's most anticipated moment was the election of a new president. But messengers also tackled a slate of resolutions on racial issues, abortion, and the Equality Act, a sweeping piece of legislation in Congress that would extend civil rights protections on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity while eroding some religious liberty protections. A resolution on Christian citizenship included a denunciation of the Capitol insurrection of January 6, 2021. The most contentious topic heading into the meeting was critical race theory, an academic lens for analyzing racism in society and institutions that has swept the imagination of American conservatives. Republican-controlled state legislatures have passed measures against the perceived influence of CRT in public schools. On Tuesday afternoon, messengers passed a resolution that the denomination, which was founded before the Civil War in defense of slavery, reaffirm its 1995 apology for systemic racism, but also reject any theory or worldview that denies that racial discrimination is rooted in sin. At its 2019 annual meeting in Birmingham, Alabama, messengers affirmed that critical race theory could be used by faithful Baptists, a moment that many conservatives in Nashville characterized as galvanizing. The months leading up to the convention have seen a series of high-profile departures and unusually poisonous clashes by an organization that prides itself on unity in the essentials of the faith. Russell Moore, the denomination's head of ethics and public policy, left on June 1st. In two letters that leaked after his departure, he accused the denomination's executive committee of a pattern of intimidation against sexual abuse survivors and spiritual and psychological abuse. Many Baptists hoped that after months of savage sniping online, the act of gathering in the same room would have a soothing effect. But the meeting in Nashville included several moments of unusually direct confrontations. On Monday afternoon, Mr. Mahler was accosted inside the convention center by a young messenger who loudly accused him of allowing critical race theory into the seminary he leads. Mr. Mahler, arguably the most well-known face within the denomination, was holding his young grandchild in his arms when the angry man approached him. He left the scene more than a little shaken, he said later. Mr. Greer's office confirmed a similar confrontation a few days ago, with a messenger confronting the denomination's president in the convention center and urging him to repent. The convention was riveted on Monday by conflicting accounts of an impromptu encounter between Mr. Stone and Hannah Kate Williams, a victim of sexual abuse who has advocated reform in the denomination. Ms. Williams was in an atrium of the convention center handing out copies of a statement signed by several victims who were calling for an outside audit of patterns of abuse. Mr. Stone approached her and introduced himself, seemingly without knowing about her advocacy. The encounter soon turned ugly in Ms. Williams' account. He said, "I'm causing more harm to the Southern Baptist Convention than good, and I'm not doing right by survivors," she recalled tearfully on Monday evening. And he said, "The Southern Baptist Convention is bigger than my problems." Mr. Stone characterized the conversation as polite in a statement posted to Twitter. "At no time was I unkind." At the news conference after his victory, Mr. Litton called for an independent investigation into the convention's handling of abuse and said the denomination needed to be pastoral in its approach to victims. The divide in the convention was apparent in the run-up to Tuesday's voting. At a standing-room-only breakfast hosted by the Conservative Baptist Network on Tuesday morning, Rod Martin, a member of the denomination's powerful executive committee, exhorted attendees to not grow discouraged if the day did not go as they hoped. "If we do not prevail today, we will come back next year and the next year and the next year," he told the enthusiastic crowd. "Most of Jesus' apostles," he pointed out, "were eventually martyred. We are here to the death," he added. "We will not stop." We'll wrap up this week with an article from the Associated Press that we'll need to edit for time, but it's a local article. North Carolina governor again vetoes gun rights bill for more churches. This is by Gary Robertson of the Associated Press, Dateline Raleigh. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper vetoed gun rights legislation on Friday that would allow parishioners at more churches to be armed, marking the second year in a row that he's blocked the idea. The legislation affirms that people going to religious services at a location where private schools or some charter schools also meet can carry handguns in full view or under clothing if they have a concealed weapons permit. There would be other limits. The Democratic governor said the measure, which cleared the legislature last week, would endanger educators and children. State law otherwise prohibits guns on educational property for nearly everyone. "For the safety of students and teachers, North Carolina should keep guns off school grounds," Cooper wrote in his veto message. The bill's supporters contend these houses of worship where K-12 schools also are located are at a security disadvantage for their congregants compared to standalone churches. There are no such blanket prohibitions in these churches on carrying a pistol, provided the person has a purchase permit or concealed weapons permit. The bill also contains another provision that allows additional law enforcement employees, such as a civilian front desk worker at a police station, to carry a concealed weapon on the job if the police chief or sheriff allows it, and if the person has a concealed permit. We've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News. We thank you very much for tuning in and hope you've enjoyed the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget that podcasts are available of this and other episodes of Religion in the News at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Just click the Listen tab and then select the podcast section. We hope you'll tune in next time. Thanks again for listening today. This has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.